From Radio Vermont, it's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV. It's your show about the people, places, and the issues that matter the most to you. Now here's your host, Dave Graham.
Good morning, Vermont. It is Tuesday, April the 28th, 2020. Got a good full show lined up for you this morning. We're going to be talking a little bit of politics, COVID-19, President Trump, etc., with Matt Dickinson, a political science professor at Middlebury College, an occasional guest on the Dave Graham Show here in the first half hour. Dan Richardson will be joining us next. He is a former president of the Vermont Bar Association, a very active attorney based in Montpelier, and a frequent guest on our program, our sort of legal analyst, we like to call him. And he's got an interesting case. There was just a court ruling yesterday about a man up in Chittenden County who was importing face masks from China and selling them at quite a markup to hospitals in Vermont. And the attorney general argued that this was price gouging, and the judge has agreed. So we're going to be talking with Dan Richardson about that case in the second part of the show. And then later on, Josh Kelly joins me. He is first, Elena Treen of Axios will be visiting with us briefly after the top of the hour, talking about what's going on out there on the national scene. She's one of our new up-and-comer national correspondents we've been going to with Axios, a terrific online website. And in the last part of the show, Josh Kelly will be joining me. He is with the Department of Environmental Conservation, kind of oversees the waste issues there, all the different kinds of trash and recycling programs and alternative recycling we do in Vermont and so on. And he's going to be talking about some changes that have been put in place in those programs related to the COVID-19 crisis, and trying to increase that social distancing and make sure that you do not pass on any viruses or catch any viruses in the whole process of getting rid of household waste and so on. So that'll be an informative conversation, I'm sure, as well in the second hour of the program. But let's start right off with Matt Dickinson. As I mentioned, he is at Middlebury College, teaches political science there. And good morning, Matt. Thank you so much for joining me.
Good morning, Dave. Glad to be with you.
And I wanted to just sort of review sort of some of the events of recent days. The president is seems to be in a little bit of hot water over some of his activities at these daily briefings on the COVID-19. Last week, he got a lot of heat for allegedly making reference to the possibility of injecting disinfectants as a method of treating the COVID-19. Immediately, a lot of Trump supporters went into overdrive trying to defend him and say that this is all just media hype. And I'm wondering, what was your take on all of that? Did you think that that it was overblown by the media? Was there inaccurate reporting? Was it fairly accurate reporting and just a verbal stumble by the president, or was it not much at all?
Well, I think the comments were accurately reported. I mean, it was hard to get the story wrong. It was, if you watch these press briefings, it was pretty clear what he said. Whether it was overplayed or not, I think misses the point, which is these briefings are supposed to be doing two things. One is update the public on the status of the coronavirus, the efforts by the government to handle it, but also to reassure. And when a president makes a comment like that, it just feeds the news cycle and it steps on his own message. And whether it was overblown or not, it's something at this point Trump and certainly his advisors have to insert a certain amount of discipline. These briefings are going to serve a broader purpose. And I think, there was some talk and media leak about whether the president should even be doing these. And if you saw his last one yesterday, much more disciplined, he stayed right on message. But, historically, he's just been unable to do that.
Yeah, it does seem that he does let himself kind of meander around various issues, and some of them really seem rather tangential. He gets into these little personality fights with people, and of course with the overall news media in general. Do you think he has any legitimate complaint? I mean, are reporters really showing too much ideological bias? Are they out to get him? Are they being unfair to him, or are they sort of responding to a very unusual performance by a president?
Well, I mean, the president, there's always been a symbiotic sort of love-hate relationship between the national media and the press. They need each other, but they come to this joint news venture from different perspectives. The president wants his message out there relatively unfiltered, with a focus on only the good news. The media's job is, you know, to get beneath that and speak to what they think is the underlying issues. I think what's different is social media has shortened the news cycle to such a degree that there's a hyper-competitiveness out there, and the traditional news sources over the last couple of decades are just hemorrhaging money. And the ones that have survived in this landscape, like the New York Times and the Washington Post, have done it by adopting a more overtly adversarial position. So I think there's some legitimacy here from Trump's perspective that the media seems even more willing to, you know, speak truth to power in a way that maybe distorts the message. But frankly, it goes both ways. President Trump, more than any previous president, I think, absolutely relishes these types of adversarial sort of confrontations on television, calling reporters fake news to their face and, mm-hmm. and refusing to take questions for them. And that really plays to his base. So I think both parties are playing a role here.
And, I mean, I wonder, though, whether this is a disservice in terms of the news media do have an important role to play in our society. And, you know, I'm a reporter by background and training, and spent more than 30 years working for the Associated Press. So, you know, I'll confess that bias or urge to defend the news media right up front. But I do think they perform an important role, and if President Trump succeeds in peeling off a significant share of society, which basically dismisses the entire mainstream media out of hand, is that healthy for a democracy?
Well, I don't think it is. I mean, part of the issue here is in this, and you have more experience than anybody here, so I don't need to tell you this, with this pressure of short news cycles, there is a sense that major news stories, although infrequent still, are still being reported inaccurately. And it just takes one or two high-profile incidents for that to happen for Trump and his supporters to try to dismiss all news media coverage. And I just think that's not good for the news media. It's not good for democracy. You do not want... It's one thing to push back on a specific story and the president say that's unfair and perhaps the news media agreeing and correcting it. It's another to push back against the actual legitimacy of the role of a news outlet in reporting politics on a day-to-day basis. Calling them fake news, I think, is really not good for democracy.
And in the case of the of these remarks the other day, it was sort of a strange presentation the president put on. I mean, I watched it several times, and I sort of thought, well, he's turned toward where Dr. Birx is sitting, and he could be sort of musing out loud there. I wondered, though. I mean, that's a very different strategy from what you normally get from a president in my lifetime. Normally, their remarks are very well kind of scripted and prepared, and oftentimes they're just reading off a teleprompter. But even in cases of the give and take with the press corps, they sort of have prepared answers and so on, and talking points, et cetera. And here we have this president who is musing out loud about maybe, I don't have the exact words in front of me, but sort of speculating that maybe you could, and it's worth checking out, this idea that you could use you can inject a disinfectant, just for one example. You also talked about using light and heat and so on, but and it seemed to be that's what really resulted in a lot of the joking and the snark and stuff out there about Clorox and Lysol, et cetera. And I just, it struck me that a smarter move might have been to, if you really have a question like this, is it possible to use something like disinfectant in the treatment of a virus in the lungs? Well, I would I would probably save that question for a private meeting with Drs. Birx and Fauci or whoever else, the kind of the experts, and say, you know, let's talk about this behind the scenes before we roll it out at a news conference. Does that make sense?
It was a perfect sense. I mean, I think what Donald Trump has failed to grasp is that when you are in the bully pulpit, the words that you speak as president matter more than the words that you speak as private citizen Donald Trump or mega celebrity Donald Trump.
Absolutely.
And you have, there comes a certain responsibility here. And Birx, if you heard her express her frustration that the media was still running with this story 48 hours later, I understand her frustration because it detracts from the serious issues that she's trying to get across. But it's not the media's fault. You know, it's the president, and she tried to explain it. Well, he likes to think out loud. Well, you can't think out loud as president of the country when you're on the national stage and you're holding a press conference to set parameters about what is and what is not feasible in terms of dealing with the coronavirus. You just can't do that. You have a responsibility to measure your words carefully and realize their implications. And Donald Trump has not, to this point, exercise the kind of discipline that typically is associated with being president.
The other thing that I think even makes this more, makes that point more important is that we're talking about an illness here in which patients can, you know, get into a very desperate situation, and their families are in this very desperate situation. They are in try anything mode, and they hear the president of the United States make any kind of reference, you know, use the words disinfectant and injection in the same sentence. And there's a tendency to run with that. And so that's why we saw news reporting, including on places like Fox News over the weekend, that public health agencies in from Maryland to California were getting hundreds of phone calls from people asking about, hey, is this for real? Can we think about using disinfectant and injecting it to fight the coronavirus? And I just think that when you think about the individual families out there and patients who are in these absolutely desperate, you know, frankly, sometimes last hours of life, they are in try anything mode. And I think it's a real tragedy to put these ideas out there without them being as thoroughly vetted as possible ahead of time. I mean, that's a big part of the problem here.
Well, I think so, partly too, social media, as we talked about earlier, amplifies that tendency. Because mm-hmm. snippets of conversations can get repackaged and circulated and purport to be, you know, legitimate. The president has even backed this solutions. And as you said, it has that unfortunate impact.
And I just, you know, I mean, I think that there really is, there's a duty here, which I wish the president would think about it. And that is this idea of really trying to put out information that's helpful. I mean, the media will do what the media will do, and we have the First Amendment and freedom of speech, and social media are under the First Amendment as well. And, you know, they have less of, frankly, a duty. And you see the incredible wide range. Some media will report the stuff just absolutely straight. Others will say, you know, this is a crazy idea from the get-go, and we're really going to downplay it. And I think, you know, the range of media include joking on late-night TV, you know, when the comedians come out at 11:30 and start making fun of the idea of injecting some kind of disinfectant to fight an illness. That whole range of stuff will happen. And to me, the real problem, or the seed of the problem, is not... And I mean, I just saw the media get bashed over and over again all weekend. And I mean, they seem to be the favorite whipping child of, you know, even people who are writing what appear to be fairly serious op-ed columns. The first person in this case to use the words disinfectant and injection in the same sentence was the president of the United States.
Well, that's absolutely right.
So,
you have been in this business long enough to know that the business is undergoing, the media business, a tremendous transformation, and there's huge financial pressures. Having said that, you know, the alternative for all the media bashing here, is a system without any independent corroboration or efforts to assess what our elected leaders are doing. And I think of the options, the current system in which we have a media, however flawed it is, versus mm-hmm. a state-run, information service, which sometimes you get the feeling some politicians would prefer. I'll take the flawed media any day.
Yeah, and I guess the thing to remember about it also is it is not all one thing. I think a lot of people sort of see the media as this monolithic force, even to the point of I know this is a total rearguard action. I'm pretty much given up on the idea of media being a plural noun and that we should use plural verbs with it. The media are instead of the media is. And I've in the past I've argued that people worry about over concentration about when Time Warner buys whatever other big media company, people get nervous about too much power in one ownership. Well, once we get to where we can really legitimately say the media is, I don't know, maybe if Fox News and the New Republic will be under the same ownership or something, but. A little bit of a tangent there. I wanted to ask you also, Matt Dickinson, Middlebury College political science professor, look ahead to the general election, which is not that far off in the future. I mean, it's the way time's at a warp right now. But how does all this translate there? Do you think that we see that the Trump's poll numbers are down some? Does he still have a chance of pulling it out? Is some of this going to be a question of what the alternative is? Or tell me what your thoughts are currently.
Well, we're in uncharted territory with the coronavirus. Historically, yeah. Presidents who are in their first term representing a party that had been out of the White House for two terms have an advantage. We know that usually boosts their reelection chances. Also, when the economy was doing well, we also know the incumbent president tends to benefit from a good economy. So he had a couple of structural factors working his way. But if you heard Kevin Hassett yesterday say, we are on the verge of, an economic recession that'll curdle your hair, with unemployment levels at the second quarter GDP not seen since the Great Depression. Now, some other advisors are pushing back on that. Well, the second quarter GDP numbers are often a very good telltale indicator of the upcoming election. And if those numbers track what previous elections have done, Donald Trump is doomed. But what we don't know is, whether voters are going to treat this economic downturn in terms of voting the way they have done in previous elections. I mean, how much blame can you give the president for an economy that's gone south because of measures designed to, restrict the flow of the coronavirus? Nobody really mm-hmm. knows. And the second thing is, a lot of advisors are saying, yeah, the second quarter is just going to be dismal. But when you get into that third quarter, just in the month right before the election, we're going to see signs of an economic upturn, sort of this V-shaped economic sort of trend. Now, who knows if that's going to come true? But if it does, you might make the argument that Trump will sort of benefit from the rebound. And, of course, the other factor, as you point out, is Joe Biden, the presumptive nominee, is struggling a little bit here with some issues dealing with a former aide. The story about whether she was sexually harassed and is just beginning to gain traction. We don't know how that's going to play out. So, I'm less confident here, Dave, than I would have been in previous elections that I can say we're pretty sure, based on forecast models, this is how this is going to turn out. I just think there's a lot of uncertainty out there.
Yeah, it's got to be a maddening time for a political scientist like yourself who does have sort of formulas, I guess, from past elections and so on, where you can look at, as you were just doing, you were kind of going through what sounded to me like your the exercise that is common to your profession, and yet none of that really applies here, or at least if it does apply at all, we don't know exactly to what degree, and to what degree these other forces, this weird pandemic and the weird economy resulting from it, are going to be factors. So I guess it is pretty difficult to read. I do wonder whether the president, though, even, you know, we've talked now about the external factors there, but let's go back for a moment to his own case and ask whether to what degree some of his own behaviors may hurt him. I mean, this is going to be the only impeached president, right, ever to seek re-election.
I mean, yeah.
And that right there is kind of an amazing fact. Now, that his supporters will dismiss that out of hand as just saying that was a political hatchet job by the Democrats, et cetera. But they were able to muster enough of a case at least to get an impeachment done. There is all this stuff hanging out there. I just finally got finished reading Crime in Progress, this fascinating book by two former Wall Street Journal reporters who went on to found Fusion GPS, and it kind of goes back to the whole the role of Michael Cohen and all the whole story of Russia's involvement in the 2016 election and so on. And it just struck me that it's amazing how all of the discussion in the country these days, I mean, it's all focused on coronavirus. It seems as though we have completely forgotten all of this other stuff out there. You know, the fact that this administration and the campaign that brought it to office had 27 criminal convictions by November, less than 3 years into office. That's a pace that's never been exceeded in U.S. history, not even by the Nixon administration. These are convictions not by, you know, they aren't indictments, they aren't speeches by Adam Schiff, they are actual findings by an independent judiciary. I just find that to be amazing, and it's getting no attention. What's up with that?
Right. Well, this is part of the coronavirus impact. That's sort of all coronavirus all the time. As we get into the general election, the opposition candidate Joe Biden is going to make his case in part by always when an incumbent president is on the ballot, it is a referendum on his actions, and those issues you've cited will come up. They are not going to affect the base, as they've already played that out and found made their decision. They're not going to really drive hardcore partisan Democrats closer to Biden. They're already wedded to him. What we're looking at is in 10 states, roughly 10% of the voters whose votes are up for grab. And the issue that you bring up that I think is most crucial here is there Trump fatigue? I mean, is the constant on daily battle between Trump and the media, divisive comments, at what point does the public just, those independent voters who are going into the voting booth, do they get tired of this? Do they get tired of the constant controversy? And if so, will Joe Biden prove to be a safe, reassuring, steady hand alternative? I think that's the crux of how this this election is going to turn out, how that 10% answer that question.
Do you think that to the extent that Biden might try to reinvigorate or fan whatever sparks are left of the whole corruption issue surrounding Trump, does he have enough of his own problem that maybe that'll be less effective for him?
It depends on how it's framed. I think his strong suit is experience, stability, professionalism, normalcy. I think if he runs on that as an alternative to sort of the circus show that has been surrounding Trump since he announced his candidacy, that plays to Biden's favor. If you get into the gutter on specific details, you know Trump is a counterpuncher. He will come out and throwing everything he's got at every aspect of Biden's campaign. So I often, tell my students, you know, one of the questions a candidate has to ask is how I want to frame the narrative. Biden might be better off framing this as I'm not going to get down there in the gutter, calling Trump supporters deplorables and sort of running ads about all the statements he's made. That did not work for Hillary Clinton. I might instead try to get above the fray and contrast my statesmanship approach to Donald Trump's more in-your-face approach. That may be the stronger way to go about it here.
Yeah. I think Biden could probably sum up his if this is actually supported by facts, which I think it is, but maybe his sum up his advantage in two words, which is fewer tweets.
Yes.
I mean, you know, that's one of the amazing aspects of this president is the fact that so much of what he does and says is on this fairly new social medium that frankly is just sort of built for controversy, and I don't know whether that's ever going to be repeated in the same way. I kind of doubt it, at least in the near future. And so we'll have to see whether that return to normalcy idea is clearly one that might work for Biden. So. All right, well, we'll have to see how it all plays out. We can prognosticate all day, but we don't have all day, Matt. Matt Dickinson, our political science professor at Middlebury College, I want to thank you so much for joining me this morning. It's always good talking with you.
Always a pleasure, Dave.
All righty, we're going to head into a bottom-of-the-hour break for some CBS News, a couple words from our sponsors. When we return, we'll be talking with our legal analyst, Dan Richardson, about a case of price gouging. What is price gouging? Did it occur here? We'll hear from Dan about that. And we'll be back, folks. Stay with us.
Lawson's Finest, classic clothing in cutting-edge fashion. Our huge sandwiches and grab-and-go meals, toys, a wide selection of rosé, jewelry, accessories, quarter-pound cookies, and even more beer. Yankee Magazine doesn't call us the best one-stop shopping in Vermont for nothing. The Warren Store. We're funky, friendly, and almost world-famous.
News Radio WDEV FM and AM. Now back to the Dave Graham Show.
Thanks for staying with us into the second half hour of our program this morning. And we have one of our frequent guests on the Dave Graham Show. Dan Richardson is our legal analyst. He's a former president of the Vermont Bar Association and a very active attorney in Montpelier, and actually now a Montpelier city councilor, I do believe. Dan Richardson, thank you so much for joining me.
My pleasure, Dave.
And we were talking yesterday about a few different legal issues and so on, one of which, just breaking news, it was this case out of Chittenden County in which an entrepreneur, shall we say, was importing face masks from China for use by healthcare workers, and then reselling them at quite a markup. I think I saw in VTDigger.org that this markup was about 2,400%. I don't know if you've done the math and been able to confirm that, but that got the attention of the Attorney General, who called it price gouging, and the case goes to court. And tell us what happened.
Sure. So what happened was the Attorney General brought an action against this person, Shelley Palmer, who's actually runs a security business. But had been selling masks to Central Vermont Medical Center and other places. But specifically, these allegations were about Central Vermont Medical Center selling surgical masks at $2.50 per mask. And the Attorney General had come across paperwork that had indicated these masks were about 10 cents a piece, that was the base price that Mr. Palmer had paid. There's some dispute. Mr. Palmer has alleged that's incorrect. That was more for tariff purposes, to avoid tariffs, than anything else. But even if you take his numbers, which range anywhere from about 55 cents to a dollar as his base price investment, doubling that price doubling it in a half, getting to the 250 per mask is a pretty substantial markup. And so the Attorney General brought the action under the Consumer Fraud Act, which prohibits unfair methods of competition in commerce and unfair or deceptive acts or practices. And this would fall under a deceptive act or practice. And the consumer fraud is one of those statutes that actually, there's a few statutes in the Vermont books that have a stated purpose. And the Vermont Consumer Fraud Act, the Public Records and Public Meeting Acts both have stated purposes, which usually is what lawyers spend a lot of time fighting about. Like, what is the intent of this law? And the Consumer Fraud Act is pretty clear up front that this it's intended to be liberally construed as a way of protecting consumers and enforcing, you know, various trade regulations so that we don't have, you know, this sort of caveat emptor kind of marketplace where anybody can do anything. And in this case, you know, price gouging during a crisis is considered an unfair act. And what happened was, so the initial complaint was filed, but a motion for a preliminary injunction was filed along with it, which is basically asking the court to say, put a hold on this, make him stop doing this right now. We may not get to the rest of the case for a while, but for the very least, this is a critical situation. You got to stop it. And so courts are usually very reluctant to enforce a preliminary injunction. You have to show a certain number of elements, which include, you know, likelihood of success on the merits, that when we get to this case from where we sit today, the party getting the injunction is likely to prevail, that there's irreparable harm, meaning it's not just money, it's harm and damage to somebody or society. Often you get preliminary injunctions when somebody's about to cut down trees that are on disputed property, because once you cut down the trees, it's going to be 100 years before they grow back, and most Vermont cases don't last quite that long. So, you know, those kinds of things are the preliminary injunctions. And so in this case, Judge Tor up in Chittenden Superior granted the preliminary injunction and gave him gave the Attorney General, the power to stop this guy from selling these masks at these high prices. And so he may still sell the masks, but the price has to be monitored by the Attorney General. So what these findings indicate is that the judge clearly believed that this was, in fact, an unfair practice, and this was that price gouging itself was a fit within the Consumer Fraud Act, which is somewhat new law in Vermont. We haven't had price gouging cases. There was an effort in federal court to try and go after gas purveyors because of unfair pricing that settled out of court. But this is really one of the first where you've got a court actually making a ruling that this type of price gouging in these type of circumstances is an unfair act or practice under the Consumer Fraud Act.
The judge said selling crucial personal protective equipment desperately needed to save lives during a health emergency at a 2,400% markup is an unconscionable act in violation of public policy. I'm kind of curious about this whole thing, because I just look at the sort of normal workaday life of going out shopping for various products, and I think about what I pay versus what was paid at the wholesale level or what was paid at the manufacturing level for inputs and so on and so forth. And I mean, here I'll just use one example that I find kind of amazing, and that is bottled water. Water historically has been a rather inexpensive commodity, and yet you can go to a convenience store and buy a plastic bottle of it, 12-ounce bottle of water, and it's like $2. And I'm like, really? And to me, that there's a case of everybody needs water, and sometimes, you know, I'll be stopping at the convenience store and I'm very, very thirsty. And water is a fundamental necessity of life. And so here I am. I'm at the cooler, and I'm going to pay $2 for this plastic bottle of water, you know, that probably cost for somebody to take out of the ground, thousands of gallons of it would cost less than $2. Am I onto something there?
Well, yes and no. I mean, you know, this is where the difficulty, and this is actually where the defendant's defense laid at this a little bit, which is, you know, to a certain extent, it's not price gouging if people will pay for it. You see this also with pharmaceuticals, where, you know, a drug stops being generic for a period of time and goes up in price, or a new owner decides
a lot.
Ramp up the price a lot, you know, insulin or gout medication, those kind of things that can just all of a sudden spike in price because they are commonly used. The, you know, and that's not to say that there that's okay or that's kosher. It is to say that it just is the difficulty in part of trying to regulate supply and demand in what is generally a free market. You know, going back to what I was saying about caveat emptor, I mean, laws like consumer protection laws are you know, they're designed to put some guardrails on the marketplace, but they aren't intended to regulate the marketplace in a micro sense. They're really intended to take out the worst of the worst, the bad actors. And so in a, you know, in a normal case, you can have a markup in a supply and demand situation where, you know, that's simply what the market requires. I mean, think about like concert tickets that have gone, you know, through the roof that have a extensive amount of markup. I mean, there have been threats to challenge some of that as unconscionable or unreasonable. In this particular case, I think why the court was able to so clearly make this ruling is in part that, you know, this is a market, what we would call a market emergency, and it's actually defined by statute within the Consumer Fraud Act. And so, you know, because there is this critical situation where masks are in high demand, as a matter of life and death, this type of markup that's occurring does violate that because of this shortage of supplies. And, you know, you've seen some of that with like hand sanitizer and toilet paper, where people who have tried to hoard and sell it a markup have been shut down. And so this is a similar creature of that ilk.
Speaking of hand sanitizer, I saw a funny meme online a couple weeks ago where the I think it was a supermarket in Denmark was willing to sell a single bottle of hand sanitizer for $4.09. I think that's in euros. And if you wanted two bottles, it was going to be $96 or 96 euros. The anti hoarding price structure there. I don't know, but right. I got a belly laugh out of that one. And I thought we had a caller on the line, but Bill in Waitsfield. Bill, you're welcome to call back if you like. By the way, 244. That reminds me, 244-1777 is our call in number here at WDEV. That's the local number in Waterbury, and our toll-free number is 1-877-291-8255. And as always, we welcome listener phone calls. Sometimes it takes us a few minutes to get you on the air, so be patient, folks. Occasionally, one of our guests is in the middle of a thought, and I like to wait until there's an end of a paragraph or whatever. But or occasionally, we've got to wait all the way through a break or something, but patience oftentimes is rewarded with an ability to get your thoughts or questions onto our air here on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV. And so just a word to the wise. Dan Richardson, I'm wondering, you know, is this, I think you mentioned when we talked about this yesterday that there was some precedent cited in this case, and it's kind of an unusual thing, I think, but the precedent involved the same party. Is that right?
That's correct. Well, Mr. Palmer has been before the court before. He was a bail bondsman. And part of the question here was dealt with, you know, testimony at a preliminary injunction hearing. And there is an In re Palmer case out there that the attorney general cited for the principle that he could be called as a witness at this preliminary injunction hearing, which is unusual. Usually you don't have the ability to cite a case featuring the person against whom you're now seeking to impose this particular legal principle on. It occurs every now and then, but this is you know, this is part of the unique situation. Now, the AG might argue that, you know, it goes to show that this is a person who has a history of actions that have caused him to come before the court in the past, which may go to, you know, the nature of his activity, that, you know, this is someone who should know better or certainly has experience or has done bad acts in the past, which, you know, there are limitations as to what type of conclusions you can draw from that. But it's a clever way to bring that in and bring it to the court's attention, because that's public record. That's a public case law that you can look up, cite freely in court. And, you know, it's one of those small ironies that come out of practicing in a small state sometimes.
That is actually kind of fascinating. Now, this previous case involving Mr. Palmer and his role as a bail bondsman, talk to us a little bit about what that case was, if you recall its details at all.
Sure. You know, essentially this was an objection about, you know, he was being disciplined on an administrative level for his licensure, that he had failed and had a pattern. You know, the Supreme Court wrote that based on some of the above incidents they recite in the decision, that the defendant had a pattern of misconduct over the years, and that the hearing officer had concluded that he engaged in financially irresponsible conduct and untrustworthy behavior in violation of the statute governing bail bondsmen, and had his license suspended. The issue on appeal, and I'm just refreshing my recollection as we talk, it was really a question of whether he had engaged in unfair trade practices by improperly withholding his client's funds, charging his client's a premium surcharge without obtaining department approval, and violated the laws on premium financing by inserting forfeiture on default provisions into his bail bond agreements that greatly exceeded the delinquency charges allowed under statute. And so, you know, they basically upheld his suspension of his bail bondsman licensure. And, you know, in that respect, the court found that he had engaged in these activities that largely would have taken a similar tact in respect to this case, which is that he was taking too much money from his clients. And that's the way bail bonding works. You know, you have to, you're basically acting as a surety for people to show up in court. And if they don't, you're putting up some of the money that is put as a penalty in such bail situations. But you set it up so that, you know, bail bondsmen aren't charitable actors. They're in it to make profit, and, you know, but it's regulated and it has certain limitations. And he was found to have wildly exceeded those limitations. And so in the court findings, you know, that was one of them. But the other point, and probably perhaps the more relevant point why it had been cited, was that, you know, he had been called to testify. And he, you know, he said that it violated, you know, his, or actually that, sorry, he had been, he said that the regulations violated the United States Constitution, ability to make, you know, the right to make contracts, and the court rejected that we can regulate these things. You know, there's a certain trend here about, you know, he seems to be an actor who works a little outside of the system, or, you know, works in these regulated fields and runs afoul when his actions or decisions run contrary to some of the regulatory rules, is what this seems to indicate.
And in I guess simple layperson's terms, of the pattern of behavior, there might be an element here of just basically charging too much. It sounds like. I mean, is that sort of taking too much money off in the course of the business?
you know, I certainly wouldn't, you know, that's something that I think that both of these decisions and why they were probably cited. And so, you know, when you have a decision like this involving the same defendant, you know, a lawyer is going to try and find any way to cite it in the subsequent case.
That's interesting. And I know that there's there are some evidentiary rules on that limited the ability of a lawyer to sort of introduce past actions by a defendant or whatever in some cases. Is that right?
Yeah, there are. You know, the rules do prevent. You know, you can't, for example, if somebody's on the witness stand and they are a they have a prior conviction for breaking and entering, and but the issue here today is you know, this price gouging. They couldn't say we want to bring forward evidence of his prior breaking and entering in that hypothetical situation, you know, where they're being alleged to have committed some type of fraud, because the rules of evidence do not allow that, because it doesn't mean anything. It doesn't mean if the person had a prior conviction that they're likely to have committed or have more likely to acted in a guilty manner in a subsequent event. So, you know, in some ways, citing this case is a sneaky way around that kind of limitation, because you're not citing it for that purpose.
Yeah, and citing this case, I mean, it's interesting to me that this kind of gives you it punches your ticket if you want to cite the case, because by virtue of the fact that it is captioned with this person's name and it's a part of the records at the courthouse, you can sort of see how I'm going to go grab that one and I'm just going to mention it as possibly supporting the point I'm trying to make in this case, because gee whiz, familiar name there at the top of it. So
right.
That's interesting tactically for a lawyer or prosecutor in this case to try to sure. get that in front of the judge. So fascinating.
The thing though, I mean, I think that the important thing to keep in mind is that, you know, this is not a situation that this kind of gamesmanship would necessarily. I mean, it's a funny little side feature, but I think really in Judge Tor's decision, you know, it's clear that, you know, reselling these masks at this much of a markup is just something that the court was clearly uncomfortable with. And, you know, I don't think you needed this case to necessarily make the case against Mr. Palmer in this particular situation. They seem to the court seemed to be fairly comfortable with the basic facts, but it is one of those little colorful sidebars, as it were.
Yeah, I don't think the case would not have been decided differently if that caption had not been found and inserted into it. I think is what the point is there.
Sure.
But in terms of the case being decided, I mean, it really goes back to this. It seems as though it might have been influenced to some extent by the kind of the condition on the demand side, and if you focus the condition on the demand side, it gets to here we are with healthcare workers who are really under duress right now. They need personal protective equipment badly. There are many, many instances we see in being reported in the media where it's in very short supply, and that nurses and other healthcare workers are having to wear the same face mask for days in a row, et cetera, et cetera. These are huge, as you say, life and death issues. And so you don't really have a more if you're the judge looking at a potential price gouging case, it's hard to imagine a more sympathetic demand side right now. Would you agree?
I would. You know, I mean, and that's and it fits squarely within. As I said, the statute, you know, does talk about these sort of emergency situations. And given that you're talking about masks for healthcare workers, you know, this is certainly some, in any type of crisis situation, there emerge sort of these, you know, figures that are either deemed as heroes or that are, you know, people that have clearly sacrificed in these things. And so anything that's seen as, you know, going hurting them or taking advantage of them, you know, is something that's clearly frowned upon. You know, so in that respect, I think that's where the court's coming from in this decision. Is it would be different if, you know, this, I think in some ways, you know, social media might shame somebody, but it might not rise to legal activity if they were doing a markup on toilet paper and selling it out of the back of their car.
Yeah.
You know, or another type of situation. You know, we've seen things where people have shamed those people on social media, but there haven't necessarily been substantial legal actions taken because, you know, some private actor selling toilet paper because they've you know, hoarded a bunch of it. Yeah, that's one thing. And I think the market allows, to a certain extent, some of the actors to take advantage of things. But, and, you know, when somebody sort of gets into the crosshairs like this in a very public way, you know, that's often where, you know, the Attorney General or whoever is the regulatory agent can't necessarily ignore them. I mean, it becomes the dereliction of their duty in some respects not to investigate or take action if they feel that they have the evidence to support it, as they did in this case.
Well, and sure enough, the judge ruled in favor of the Attorney General on this one, and Mr. Palmer you know, was told to cut it out, basically. So there we go. Dan Richardson has been my guest. He is our legal affairs analyst and is one of the more prominent attorneys in practice these days in Montpelier, former president of the Vermont Bar Association. Dan, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
My pleasure, Dave.
And we are going to go to a top-of-the-hour break for some CBS News here on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, FM, and AM. And when we return, we'll be talking to one of our friends from Axios and then get into trash with Josh Kelly of the Department of Environmental Conservation. Stay with us, folks.
There's comfort in the familiar, but when life presents us with something exciting, we just have to embrace it. With so many of our neighbors producing such wonderful products, we just have to show and tell the world. Come in and see for yourself the old standbys alongside the new. Change is good. The one thing that never changes is our commitment to making your visit a great experience. The Warren Store. We're funky, friendly, and almost world famous.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV.
Thanks for staying with us into the second hour of our program on this Tuesday morning, April the 28th, 2020. And one of the things we'd like to do after the mid-show break is to bring in one of our regular national correspondents who get on the program here and help us broaden the lens beyond Vermont's borders and look at what's going on nationally. And helping us do that this morning is Elena Treen of Axios.com, terrific online news website that's well worth a look by folks out there. You should definitely check them out. Very tightly written stuff, right down the middle, no discernible political bias, left or right, and just excellent journalism. So, Elena Treen, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Yes, thank you for having me, Dave.
And tell us a little bit about what the headlines are in Axios today.
So lots of headlines today. We've been looking at the new PPP program that was replenished last week, the Paycheck Protection Program to help small businesses. In the last few hours, we've actually seen Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin say that a lot of the people who've gotten these loans, over $2 million, they're going to be doing an audit eventually to see whether they deserved that loan or not. And that was spurred by places like Ruth's Chris and Shake Shack. And we saw the Lakers all receiving millions of dollars in small business emergency funding. And of course, a lot of people in you know, a lot of people who have small businesses across the country are getting shut out because some of these bigger places are taking that funding. And so that's kind of our big focus in Axios AM, our lead newsletter today.
Yeah, and also this geographic distribution really imbalance, you might say, Axios is reporting about, where places like Nebraska get a big share of the loans under the payroll protection program. Meanwhile, New York and California, which both are relatively hard hit by the coronavirus, are not doing as well. What's behind that, do we think?
They said that qualifying firms in states like New York and New Jersey are actually less likely to have longstanding relationships with community banks. And that seemed to make a big difference in who's getting a share of the $350 billion that was most recently allocated to help small businesses. And the reason with that, I covered closely all the negotiations on the Hill in this latest interim funding bill that allocated billions of dollars to this program. And in the first round of the PPP program, a lot of those small business community banks were not having a chance to fight with the bigger banks over how to lend. And so before, where we saw a lot of the big banks being able to dole out more money to companies that had existing relationships, now we're seeing states and small businesses who don't have relationships with maybe a smaller community bank getting shut out. And so in both instances, a lot of people saying that their existing relationships with their banks has really been the key factor in whether they've been able to get a loan processed or accepted as quickly as possible.
So if you bank on Main Street, you might be better off than if you bank on Wall Street right now, it sounds like, basically.
Yes.
One way to describe it?
I
don't know.
Yeah.
That is interesting. And I suppose a lot of people out there around the country, or even around our area, Vermont's a rural state after all, might be kind of hearing that and nodding their heads a little bit and saying, if the brakes are going to the smaller places, well, that's okay.
Right.
especially
after last time getting shut out and hearing the headlines of some of these bigger chains across the country getting these small business loans, you have to, root for the small businesses in some of these underserved communities. So it might not be a terrible thing.
Andrew Cuomo is out with a comment or two about how he wishes he had spoken up earlier and louder about the coronavirus pandemic, and of course it's had a bigger impact in his state, I think, than in any other. And so what do you make of this, and what's in it for him to make this sort of mea culpa a little bit?
Yeah. So this was. We're very fortunate. We've launched our new Axios on HBO show, the new season, I should say, and it's going to be happening every Monday, every other Monday through the rest of the year. And we were able to get Governor Cuomo on the show for last night. And, I have to say he was very compelling. I think that you see him every day giving these interviews in New York and acting as governor, but this was a bit more of a personal interview about his own handling. And I think that he admitted that there's a lot of things that he wishes that the U.S. in particular had done differently, especially way back in December when we had been given the warning signs that there was a virus quickly spreading throughout China. And he said that he wished leaders across the world, including President Trump, had paid more attention to that and just didn't believe the Chinese. And they said that they had it under control because clearly they didn't. And so it was a very compelling interview. And I think one thing that he showed a little bit of vulnerability when he said, 15,000 people have died. People are dying every day, and I can't change that. So it was a very interesting interview.
Yeah, and I think he actually, there's a capacity there for a little bit of self-criticism, self-reflection or whatever that is, shall we say, not universally shared by all of the top leaders in the United States. Is that people might take away from this?
Yes, I think that's a fair statement to make.
I haven't heard him say over and over again, "We're doing a great job." That being Cuomo, of course.
Yeah,
we're doing a great job.
Yes, I think he's very aware of not being tone deaf, really, to a lot of the. He's surrounded by, it's New York. There's more cases in New York and more deaths in New York than some countries around the globe. And so I think he's very cognizant of not saying that they're doing an incredible job and they have everything under control, because it's definitely been an uphill battle there. And so I think a lot of people appreciate that he's not quick to, you know, try to have too much of an optimistic view of what's happening when people are dying every day.
Actually, I have another question about tone, because some of that, I mean, obviously tone is an important factor. You know, ask any funeral director this, about how they want to act around, you know, the bereaved relatives of the person they're about to, you know, they're taking care of, right? You know, that it's an important feature. And the president's defense the other day against this, all the criticism he took after using the words disinfectant and injection in the same sentence, he came back the next day and said, well, he was just being sarcastic. And, you know, and I said to myself, I don't recall President Bush after 9/11 engaging in any sarcasm or snarkiness or whatever. Assuming that the president was being sarcastic, and CNN says he's lying about that, but I mean, assuming that he was, is that the right stance and the right tone?
It was a very bizarre remark, and I will say it was very confusing, especially for reporters trying to cover it, because in the hours after that, he had made those comments about, you know, the potential that ingesting disinfecting could be helpful for cleaning the lungs. We saw people like his new press secretary, Keely McEnany, come out and say, you know, not say that it was sarcastic, and actually say, listen, he said that people should talk to their doctors. And people like Deborah Birx coming online or going on television and saying, the key thing to remember is that he's saying talk to your doctors, and that sometimes he floats these ideas in the middle of a press conference before actually seeing them through. And then, of course, he later said they were sarcastic. So I do give CNN, you know, I'm not sure, you know, you can't believe whatever the president says, you have to take it as his words. But I do have a hard time as well believing that he was initially being sarcastic. But to answer your question, no, I mean, I think that the president comes out every day and there's millions of Americans watching him and listening to him for advice. And we've seen in the past when he's floated ideas or some guidance, you know, with the anti-malaria drug or hydrochloroquine, I might be butchering the way that
hydroxychloroquine, I believe it is.
Yes,
yeah.
Thank you.
Okay.
And we saw people go ahead and take that. And I think that that's a very serious thing. So, if you're going to be making a joke and not making it clear whether you're joking or not, especially when you have a country who's in mourning and people are dying every day, it's a very difficult thing to not be very clear about something as serious as that.
That's what really struck me about this, is that we do have a lot of people out there in America right now. Some are patients on their deathbeds. Others are their family members. They're desperate. They are in try anything mode. And if they hear even a hint of somebody saying, you know, disinfectant and injection or ingestion in the same sentence, they're going to say, huh, what? And sure enough, the health authorities, public health, state public health offices around the country then got inundated with phone calls with people inquiring, is this what we should be doing? And I just think to raise any hope like that in that regard, you know, and only to have it squashed hours later by these statements coming out from the makers of things like Clorox and Lysol and so on. Please don't ingest our products. I just found that. So if Trump has this thought, I mean, you know, if it crosses his mind, maybe we should, inject your Lysol or something. I could see him asking that in a private meeting with Doctors Birx and Fauci and other experts, but not rolling it out at a news conference. That's just
right.
Wow.
And he
Yikes.
Does tend to do that. I mean, one thing we've seen at these marathon press conferences every night is that he does float these ideas. Someone, one of the doctors, I mean, in this instance, a doctor came forward and said, was describing the benefits of cleaning products and fighting the disease. And of course, he was discussing it on surfaces, not ingesting it. And the president kind of took that idea and ran with it. And we've seen that happen in some of these press conferences. Of course, we reported last week, you know, in the wake of that kind of fiasco around the Lysol and disinfectant comments, the president and a lot of his advisors have been telling him to lay off some of these briefings and to actually shorten the amount of time that he's spending talking to the media and talking to the press and pulling back on some of these press conferences. So over the next few weeks, we should probably expect the president not to come out and speak as long as he has been at these press conferences for that reason.
Well, and yesterday's seemed to be a more disciplined performance than some of his previous ones. So I guess the new rules may already be taking effect here. So we'll see if that, we'll see if he can stick to them. Let's put it that way. I don't know. Well, we'll have to pick this up at another time. Elena Treen of Axios.com. I really appreciate you coming on our air on WDEV with us this morning. And let's talk again soon.
Thank you so much. Have a wonderful
day. Stay healthy. Take care. One of the effects of more people staying around their homes is that our waste streams are changing. We're generating more of different kinds of trash and maybe less of other kinds of trash. And what does that mean for our ability to get it all taken care of and taken away from our homes and handled properly? And in the realm of solid waste, we are in a world where we want to be sure that we are not spreading coronavirus from waste haulers to their customers or vice versa. So there are some new standards and rules being adopted by the state of Vermont on a variety of different aspects on the waste front that folks need to hear about. And it's not the sexiest topic in the universe, but it is something that is important. And as a public service here on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM, we wanted to bring in an expert and talk about different aspects of our waste handling habits and how they have changed and need to change in the face of the coronavirus crisis. And joining me this morning to talk about all this is Josh Kelly. He is with the Vermont Department of Environmental Conservation, and he oversees a lot of their programs relating to waste disposal in the state. And Josh, thank you so much for joining me.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here, Dave. Thanks.
And so let's talk about a few of these issues here. One of it, and some of these key off of a couple of news releases issued by your agency in the last couple of weeks, and I wanted to catch up on some of this stuff. And one has to do with our good old-fashioned bottle, you know, the habit Vermonters are in of taking their empties down to the redemption center and typically getting a nickel apiece for most of them, I guess, and maybe some of them now fetch a little more than that, but depending on what it is. Some of that is those habits are changing, need to change. Tell us what's going on that front.
Sure. Well, really in response to grocery stores being essential services and the fact that we're all trying to stay home and stay safe, DEC issued some enforcement discretion allowing retailers the option of whether to redeem bottles and cans under the Vermont's Bottle Bill program. So that doesn't mean that in many places nothing may have changed for you. Your redemption center or your grocery store may still be redeeming, but it gives them the option to decide whether they do that. And really, DEC took that step to allow grocers to focus on essential services, stocking shelves, getting food to people who need it, keeping their employees safe, focusing them on really just keeping all Vermonters fed at this time. So we have heard from some redemption centers that say, hey, we're still open and we want people to know we're still open. So I wanted to be clear that if you have bottles and cans to return, check out your redemption center. Many of them are grateful to have your business and want you to come in.
And are they able to, you know, when the redemption center takes the bottles in from customers, are they able to move them along the, I don't know if you'd call it a supply chain or exactly what, how you describe it, but obviously
the supply chain would be a great way to describe it, Dave. And yes, they are actually, industries that rely on Vermonters' aluminum and even glass and plastic bottles are really concerned that Vermonters keep recycling at this time because they make products out of those materials. Everything from tissue paper and toilet paper, which we've heard so much about from Vermonters paper that they recycle, to aluminum cans coming right back into new aluminum cans. So to keep that supply chain going and to restock shelves with new food and drink products in containers, they need that material.
Okay, and so in other words, it sounds like the real message here is, while you told retailers that they have the option of stopping redemption services, your underlying message is that this all still goes on. Smart thing to do for consumers, if you have bottles you want to get rid of, is call your redemption center, see if they're still taking them, and head on down there if they are.
Yeah, exactly. It really is just to give some flexibility to those grocers that really feel like their staffing is down and they needed to focus on essential services at this time. But absolutely,
I see.
Contact your redemption center. I can't tell you how many people are feeling like they're not making the income, you know, in businesses across the state that they once were. And so that foot traffic, if it can be done in a safe way, if people maintain their distance, many retailers are interested in people coming in safely and safe trips.
In terms of the habits folks have in their own households of storing these bottles or cans and then getting them loaded into the car and taking them down to the redemption center, does anything there need to change in the face of the coronavirus? I mean, I would have a hard time imagining people really wanting suddenly to have to start washing all of these things or whatever, but I wonder if is that something that is being advised anywhere, or is that just kind of me going off the rails here?
No, I mean, I think there's been a lot of discussion about contact from surfaces as being a threat to spread of coronavirus, and I've watched a lot of it because materials are in my business that are in what the state oversees. So we've been looking at the latest data, but it doesn't seem definitive yet. There's only some preliminary studies that have been done showing that the virus lasts longer on things like plastic than on cardboard. But what I've been seeing from the CDC and solid waste organizations and OSHA have been that traditional personal protective equipment, like wearing gloves, wearing eye protection, actually, almost more importantly from dealing with glass bottles, they can break, and you just want to be careful in general from those materials, that those things mm-hmm. are good to protect the employee, and frequent hand washing is good to protect the employee. But I would say that it's still early as we're all sort of learning more about this virus, and if a lot of these bottles and cans have sat for a decent amount of time before they get to the redemption center in some cases. But I would just say exercise patience at this time with any service provider you're working with. Give them some patience because people may not have the same staffing that they had. And we definitely want to make sure that people are staying safe at this time.
Yeah, that's the bottom line. I mean, obviously, you want to be sure people are taking whatever steps they feel they need to take to stay safe. So even if the step that you see seems debatable to you or whatever, I don't know. I suppose you're standing in line and waiting for your bottles to be counted, and the person's in there changing their gloves or something, and their disposable gloves, and you're why are we taking this extra time? No, don't go there. Just as you say, be patient and realize that everybody's adjusting the best they can to a fairly difficult new set of circumstances. We have a whole lot of waste issues to talk about here in the last half hour or so of the Dave Graham Show here on WDEV FM and AM. I want to talk briefly about food waste in a few minutes. I wanted to talk also about the alternative recycling centers around Vermont that take stuff that doesn't go into the normal recycling stream, and other issues that we'll get into some of those in the last half hour of the program after our bottom of the hour break that's upcoming. But before we go to the break, Josh, I just wanted to ask you, are you folks there in terms of the state DEC and your division and so on? Are you staffed up as normal these days, or how's your work life changed in the last couple months?
Sure. I mean, I think for everybody, nothing's normal anymore.
Yeah.
And that includes DEC. So we are working from home, the entire department. There is discussion about some of the governor's latest allowances for some more services to happen. And that may include some field work for DEC. But this is really preliminary at this moment. I did just go out and had a social distancing interview with a WCAX reporter at her house to install a home composting bin, actually, ironically, getting back to the food waste issue. She was interested in getting set up and thought it would be great to film it. So we went out and she built the bin and then installed it. And I was just sort of there to stand back and stay my 6 feet distance. So it's a new normal, but we'll see how it goes.
Got to go to a break. We'll be back with more with Josh Kelly in just a couple minutes, folks. Stay with us.
Lawson's Finest, classic clothing in cutting-edge fashion. Our huge sandwiches and grab-and-go meals, toys, a wide selection of rosé, jewelry, accessories, quarter-pound cookies, and even more beer. Yankee Magazine doesn't call us the best one-stop shopping in Vermont for nothing. The Warren Store. We're funky, friendly, and almost world famous.
All right, well, we've reestablished contact with Dave in such a fashion. Good morning again, Dave.
Good morning, Dana. And we are, I think, connected now. So that's good. And is Josh Kelly still with us, Vermont Department of Environmental Conservation?
I'm here, Dave.
Excellent. Sorry about the technical issue there. But I wanted to continue our conversation about waste streams in the time of coronavirus crisis, and I want to ask you about the. We've talked a little bit about kind of standard recycling. There's also this something I see and hear referred to as additional recycling, which is not stuff that we put in our. In the bins that, in our case, Casella hauls away from the house every couple weeks, but this is stuff that we take over to a little additional recycling center off of North Main Street in Barrie every few weeks, and they've been closed for a while, and our bin is overflowing, shall we say? And I'm just wondering, what are the prospects for getting ARCC back in gear?
Yeah, that's a good question. The Central Vermont Solid Waste District operates that center. And I think as things ease up a little bit at a time, there may be a point at which they reopen. I think many of your listeners are used to spring cleaning this time of year. And
yep.
I would just say, you know, all solid waste managers get it. We totally get it, public or private sector. But again, I think that the word patience comes in. If a hauler runs a residential route right now, they are pretty flat out because the residential trash and recycling is way up. And if you are a transfer station, you know, there are certain requirements about social distancing there. So you just really want to pay attention to what the facility requires to keep your distance from folks. And while the state of emergency is still in effect, you know, DEC has been encouraging Vermonters to really keep things simple at this time. You know, focus on the waste that you produce every single day, trash, food scraps, recycling, and bring those to your facilities if you're a drop-off customer. If you're a curbside customer, really have some sympathy for these essential workers. Haulers, if you ever watched what a waste hauler does, it is a really hands-on, tough job. And there are customers running up to haulers last minute, trying to give them a bag of trash. Don't do that. You really need to social distance from your hauler, keep 6 feet away. And some of the services they might have provided before that were very hands-on, you know, may not be available now. I know a lot of haulers help people with going into their sheds or their garages and taking trash and recycling out. They might need to be doing that more at the curb to protect their staff and also to deal with all they're dealing with, the uptick in home waste. So if you can wait on spring cleanouts and other types of additional recycling, we're definitely asking folks to do that. It is a pain because you have to have space and the bins seem to be overflowing in some cases. But it is the right thing to do right now as we start to ease into getting back to maybe what I describe as a new normal.
A new abnormal, I've heard described.
Yeah.
I guess that's the byword here then. It's patience and I guess we can probably scrounge up a second bin somewhere and just start filling that one. And eventually when things get back closer to normal, we'll be able to take care of all that stuff. But this is in our case not even really so much spring cleaning related as just the normal routine. In normal times, we tended to make the trip over to Barry every couple of months or something, and it's probably been since January now. So anyway,
right. So you've got some stuff built up, and I'm sure a lot of people do in different ways. You know, household hazardous waste events are very commonly held in the spring because, you know, once we're out of the 2 feet of snow and the sub-zero weather, people are ready to do some things and get rid of some stuff. And we totally get that. And there are materials that you have that have some value that the manufacturing stream wants. So it's a balance right now. We would just really, again, like you were saying, patience and contact your district, calling first to your facility before you bring stuff to make sure you understand what their hours are. It's the same with easing into, curbside pickup at the hardware store. I just did that the other day. All of us need to have this patience because businesses want to operate, but we want to keep safe at the same time.
Yep, it's that is for sure. In fact, some of our local businesses are it's hard. It's difficult. I had to go to the hardware store the other day, and there's this line that queues up in front of the store, and you got to wait there, and then go into the store, and they're pretty minimally staffed these days, and so you kind of have to find things on your own, or at least I did, and that's a different picture from what's normally been the history there. And it's not just any one particular store, but I think this is happening in a lot of our retail environments right now. And it doesn't really make you smile. It's sort of like, oh, darn. I mean, this is kind of a pain, but it's also something that we're all just going to have to adapt to. And do the best we can for as long as it lasts, because there aren't really many alternatives anybody's offering there. Hey, let's go to a listener who is calling in, Dennis from Montpelier. Good morning, Dennis.
Good morning. I'm not going to be forced to do this because I disagree with it. What little food scraps I have, just my wife and I actually feed about 5 crows that wait for me to throw it out for them out there in the yard. Mm-hmm. And I'm not going to, you want us to stop feeding birds because of the bears. Now, what are you going to do when the bears come around? And I've talked to a lot of people that just are not going to do this. We're not going to be forced to do this. So that's my call.
And what are you speaking about when you say this? We're not going to be forced to do this. What do you mean?
I'm not going to save my meats and get a compost bin. I don't want a compost bin around my house. I don't care to do it. Most of the population, I think. We're just hearing from people that want to do it. That's fine. But don't force us to do this.
Okay. Well, actually, Dennis, thanks for the call. I appreciate that, because that does get us to a next topic that I also wanted to cover with Josh Kelly here. And Josh, I understand that the the rules that were to take effect about no more food waste in the trash as of July 1st. Has that been delayed? Do I have that right?
There was a proposal by DEC to delay it, but the legislature hasn't taken any action on that at the moment.
Okay.
So currently it is still in place. The disposal ban on food scraps is July 1, 2020. But for all listeners, I would just say there are a lot of flexibility in that. So, for example, if people choose to compost at home, they don't have to put meat or meat scraps in their home compost bin. They can throw those in the trash. And that was actually baked into the law from the beginning, from its original passage in 2012. And then secondly, if you bring your trash to a drop-off, which a lot of Vermonters do because it saves them a lot of money, there are food scrap collection at every single transfer station across the state. So that service is there, and it's much more convenient than it ever has been. And they accept all food waste. And if you start that process, what you find is your trash does not smell. It's like it's simply a different bin that you're putting this material into. And then lastly, a lot of curbside services have started up from Montpelier to all the way up to St. Albans. There are newer residential curbside service pickup options available to folks.
And then in terms of the food scraps, then I would gather that you recommend some kind of a sealed pail or something. You put those in separate from your trash, and then if you go to the transfer station, there's a special bin that you can just empty that sealed container into, correct?
Yes, correct. Yeah, it's just a 5-gallon bucket is the most common, or old kitty litter buckets have been used a lot for this purpose.
Yep. Yeah, that's another. That's the old reuse part of the reuse, recycle, reduce, taking an old kitty litter container and using it for your food scraps. In terms of the, you said some folks are starting to install backyard compost bins themselves. We've been doing that for a while, actually, and I find that it provides us great material to put on our next year's tomatoes or whatever. So that's another option that's available. Not for everybody. I mean, there's some people who live in apartments and so on and don't really have the yard space to start messing around with compost or don't have the opportunity to mix in the leafy stuff with yard waste with the food waste and so on. But just home composting is another thing that many Vermonters do. I would gather that that's more common here than in many other states. Have you ever seen any surveys on that or anything?
Definitely Vermont has a high number of home composting activity among its residents, and I think that's probably tied to our rural nature. But I think also as a culture, you know, Vermonters are not wasteful. They're generally resourceful, and that goes with just sort of the Yankee ethic of use it up. And I just want to make sure listeners think about when we talk about food waste, what we're really looking for first and foremost is that people just think about the waste they might be creating and try not to create waste at every opportunity. So, for example, we have a website with some great tips called scrapfoodwaste.org. Scrapfoodwaste.org is the website. It has a lot of good information on reducing food waste and how you can save money at the same time. And so that's really where we want Vermonters to start, because I think at these times, saving money, and when you're home and you're cooking a lot, you can try out new recipes. You can experience ways of freezing your leftovers and start getting in different habits that actually will help you and your family over time.
In one of the other areas that I've seen material from your department, Josh Kelly, the Department of Environmental Conservation, is that you had some tips for keeping haulers and waste workers safe. And some of these I think are may sound a little obvious to folks who are following the coronavirus 6-foot distancing and all that. But tell us what some of those are.
Yeah, thanks for mentioning that, Dave. So we've definitely heard from haulers that they're stressed at this time. They're worried about their staff. They're worried about their staff safety. And as I mentioned, if you see your hauler on their day-to-day route, you know, you look out your window, see them picking up your trash and recycling, they're doing that at hundreds of stops across the state. And that's very physical, and it's really, it's close contact work. And so we're asking folks to maintain their social distancing from haulers, really not trying to run up and give them last-minute materials, to bag their trash and make sure it's tied so we don't have loose trash blowing around, and things that increase the amount of contact that haulers have to have or other waste workers have to have with trash. And as they bring out their recycling and trash bins, to wipe down the handles, even just with a bleach mixture or other disinfectant, it could even just be rubbing alcohol, and to wipe them down again when they pick them up. It's just good habits to have at these times. And furthermore, to not put dangerous items into their trash, like used motor oil or small camping propane tanks we've seen, or paint or electronic waste or household hazardous waste. During the state of emergency, it's very important to keep these essential workers safe and to safely store some of the dangerous or household hazardous waste until we have more of those collection services opening back up again. And lastly, recycling is very important. We talked about there are industries really dependent on this manufacturing stream of paper, metal, aluminum, steel, cardboard, and plastics to keep recycling. But you have to give your hauler and waste workers and recycling workers the right things. So if you're putting into your bin, you know, film plastic wrap or plastic bags, those are not recyclable in the recycling system, in the blue bin recycling system. They create work for recyclers. They have to climb into the machines and cut the plastic off of the sorting machines. So that increases their workload and their danger. So recycle the right things, and you can find out all the right info on recycling at vtrecycles.com. That's vtrecycles.com. It's the state's website with recycling information. And also you can get local specific information from your solid waste district at 802recycles.com.
Yeah, you know, that's actually another waste stream that one of these days I'm going to have to kind of count up the different waste streams that go out of a house these days, ideally. And well, one is, and we do this, I think you'll be glad to know, Josh, but if you come home from the grocery store with those sort of light brown plastic bags, or really any of those plastic bags that that our grocery stores are typically using these days, they actually get collected up in a bag, and you can use one of the bags as sort of a collection bag, and then they go back to the grocery store, right? Nice trip.
Yeah, correct. Yes, many grocery stores have film recycling take back, sort of at the end of the registers in a bin, for plastic bags like bread bags and shopping bags that they take back. And those are often recycled into things like plastic decking, lumber. We've seen that in composite decking in many cases being used for that film material. But better yet, bring reusable bags once we're back to more normal times so that you don't create that waste in the first place. But I think for Vermonters, there's a lot of time. We're all spending time watching the media, watching the news. But we have maybe some of us more time on our hands to think about waste than we normally do. We're really busy. And so this is a time to learn maybe what's recyclable, what's not, maybe how to shop differently to reduce waste before it even starts. And maybe some of the things you didn't know you could recycle, like, for instance, alkaline batteries, your single-use flashlight batteries, maybe changing out your smoke alarm batteries would be a good thing to do at these times. And those are recyclable at drop-off centers. So when those become more and more services start opening up, you can start learning where you can take that material.
And again, there's a website that where you can go and review all of these facts, I gather?
Yes, vtrecycles.com. is the best place to go.
That'll have all the information. I also am interested in terms of just. Have you ever counted up the number, if you live in an ideal Vermont household, how many different waste streams there are now exiting the house? I'm sort of curious about this now, because I think about, you know, the sort of traditional trash that's just, you know, collecting, I don't know what's left, really, maybe not much. And that's one of the interesting, perhaps, accomplishments in this whole movement here. But you've got one kind of exit ramp for your food waste, and another exit ramp for your miscellaneous trash, and another exit ramp for your grocery store bags, to the extent you're using them, especially during this coronavirus crisis when a lot of stores don't really want you bringing in your cloth reusable bags, and et cetera. I mean, it seems like there's sort of exit ramps are there for the kind of waste that is generated now by the typical Vermont family?
You know, I think a good analogy would be like a menu. Some people like to have a large diversity of foods that they eat. Some night they might like to take to make Indian food. Another night they're making, you know, steak and potatoes. So everybody has different likes, and I think waste is similar. You really can go really deep on your waste stream and get into the habit of recycling all different types of materials and thinking about ways to reduce your consumption in multiple ways. And we certainly are here to encourage you in that process, and so are your solid waste districts and alliances and towns. But for keeping it simple, really, the state is looking for folks to keep recycling at these times, to think about how to reduce food waste. And if they would like to compost at home, they can, but it's not required. There are so many opportunities to do drop-off of your food scraps that make it easy. And other than that, it's really up to you. Like, things are getting easier and easier by the day. So when you paint your house, if you have leftover paint, you can bring it back to many hardware stores where you bought it, and it's recycled there through the Paint Care program. But really, starting simple is a good way. And thinking about less waste, not necessarily having to focus on zero waste, just trying to do less.
Josh, we're about out of time, but I appreciate all the information. And one more time on the website.
VTRecycles.com is a great, great resource.
Josh Kelly of the Department of Environmental Conservation, thank you so much. That's about it for today's Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM. We'll talk to you all tomorrow. Stay tuned now for Bill Fair, Common Sense Radio, folks.